Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Former Obama Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, now the mayor of Chicago, once said that the White House is great for family life, for the family that lives there. Today from the White House, a summit on real working families. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 23rd of June. Great to have you with us, everybody. Don't look now, but yes, the White House did hold another policy summit today. This one, as I said, was on working families. Plenty of star power there, if you will. President Obama, of course, the man himself. Vice President Biden as well. So too, actress Christina Hendricks, because I guess she plays a single working mom on Mad Men. I don't know. The point is this. We talk a good game in this country, but the fact is that on a lot of working family issues, the United States is not much more than an outlier. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going.
There were panels and plenaries on topics like caregiving and compensation. Victoria Budson was on that second one. She runs the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard. The U.S. has some dubious distinctions, she says. For one, it's
the only industrialized nation in the world that has no mandatory paid leave.
About 10% of Americans in the private sector can get some paid leave when they have kids. Pamela Stone is a sociologist at Hunter College.
This is a real black eye for the United States.
She says today's summit was designed to get more Americans to take notice.
Something like this is really important for raising the visibility of the issue, but also for legitimating the issue. I mean, telling people out there, this is an issue for you.
The president lent some legitimacy, but the White House must have figured some star power.
Good morning, I'm Christina Hendricks.
Could boost the summit's visibility or get some more Americans to watch its live stream. Hendricks said she was proud to be representing, as she put it, a working woman in two decades. Hendricks, the actress, and the character she plays on Mad Men.
One who is fighting in the past for equality, and one who is very, very excited to finally see that dream realized. Thank you so much for having me.
The upshot of today's summit, however, is that dream has not been fully realized. Linda Hauser is a professor of social work at Widener University. She says these issues have become more and more visible.
There are very few people that in the course of their lives don't either care for a child or an adult.
But despite that, policies have not kept up. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
This morning, the Supreme Court upheld in broad substance the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to regulate carbon emissions from sources like power plants. On a coincidental but unrelated note, former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson came out this weekend in favor of a tax on carbon as a way to fight climate change. As he is wont to do, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman then weighed in and said basically, "Yeah, that's great, Hank, but Congress will never pass a carbon tax, so what we need to think about are second-best solutions." Marketplace's Dan Weissman looks at what those second-best solutions might be and what they might cost.
Regulating carbon like other pollutants doesn't work. It's everywhere. Producing energy, driving cars, manufacturing your cell phone.
We're talking about hundreds of millions of sources. So the whole notion of trying to reduce those emissions with source-by-source regulations is simply infeasible.
Bob Stavins is an environmental economist at Harvard. A carbon tax is a tax on fuel sources, proportionate to how much carbon each source emits. So a carbon tax is like a bug bomb. Everything else, the second best solutions, is running around your apartment with a fly swatter. Michael Greenstone from MIT may have a better metaphor for those second best solutions.
I like to think of all of these policies as a bit like a bank shot in the game of billiards. You're shooting the ball to one side of the table, although the pocket is on the other.
So it's harder to make your shot, and you may hit something you don't mean to. He uses fuel efficiency standards for cars as an example. They do make cars more fuel efficient.
They also cause people to drive more.
Because more fuel efficient cars are cheaper to drive. And the EPA's new power plant regulations aim at carbon intensity, not carbon emissions. Dan Caffeine is from the University of Colorado.
It sort of acts like a tax on coal, but a subsidy to gas.
because gas is less carbon intensive than coal.
But really what we want is a tax on both coal and gas.
Because both do emit carbon. Evaluating the trade-offs creates work for economists.
You know, given this menu of second best policies, you know, how do they compare to the reference point of doing nothing?
Because doing nothing is the other alternative. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Far be it for me to say that Wall Street was boring today, but man, was Wall Street boring today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Who among us has never bounced a check? All right, those of you who haven't are more responsible than I am, I suppose. But an article in the Washington Post the other day revealed a side of the bounced check industrial complex not widely known. Danielle Douglas, reporter for the Post, wrote about a software engineer in Kansas City making $100,000 a year who couldn't get a bank to let him open an account, in part because of a financial database called Chex Systems, C-H-E-X Systems. Danielle, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
This seems kind of bizarre. A guy making $100,000 cannot get a bank account. How does that happen?
Well, essentially, the subject of my story was sent into Chex Systems, which is a consumer database that tracks all of your overdraft, bounced checks, and reports that to banks as a flag for potential risk. Now, traditionally, banks use these kinds of consumer databases to look for fraud, but as a lot of the banks became a lot more wary of consumers who posed potential risk, they started to use them to at least weed out some of those customers. And that's what happened to this guy.
Yeah, when you say weed out, that is to say deny them bank accounts. Say, we don't want
essentially
your business. What is enough to get me on this list? If I bounce, I don't know, 5 checks, will that do it? 10 checks?
Generally not. I mean, a lot of times people end up on these kinds of databases because their accounts have been involuntarily closed, meaning that they owed a certain amount because perhaps they have overdraft a lot and they haven't paid off any of those amounts for a period of time, and then they end up in the system. However, a large problem is that a lot of people are starting to generate files and not necessarily have any problems in their bank accounts. And this is something that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is looking into to make sure that if people do end up in the system erroneously, they're able to clear their name.
You know how problems with your credit score stay on there for like 7 years or something? Is it the same way with your file and check system?
Unfortunately, yes. Most of these accounts will have some kind of bad mark in your file for up to 7 years, which is a problem. If you're trying to get back into the traditional banking system, then it's going to be difficult to get a checking or a savings account.
Tell me about these prepaid debit cards, like the one that the guy in your story uses. He basically stores his worth on there, in essence, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he does. And it's interesting because maybe about 10 years ago, there was a lot of concern, or even 5 years ago, there was a lot of concern about the fees associated with these cards, like withdrawal fees, maintenance fees. But the entrance of players like Walmart and American Express and JPMorgan Chase into this market has lowered a lot of those fees. So you don't have to deal with that aspect of it as much. But the other thing is that there are certain limitations. Like I mentioned in the story, this guy has to pre-authorize every check that he signs. And if you do have big ticket expenses, then that's probably not the best way that you want to be able to handle your money.
It's funny how you never realize until you come across these stories what a simply just how aggravating and thoroughly frustrating it can be not to have access to the banking system.
Certainly. And what's interesting is that after the story came out, I was contacted by several people who were in similar situations. These were professionals who in college came and ran into problems with their financial accounts. Their names ended up in check systems and they've been battling with the banks and credit unions to try to get back in. And in the meantime, I mean, this has been a windfall for companies like Walmart and American Express because they're able to pick up these customers. But the main issue is that you still want to be able to have access to the banking system. Because you may need a mortgage, you may need a car loan, and that traditionally is probably the best way in order to obtain those sorts of products.
Danielle Douglas, she is a financial reporter at the Washington Post. Danielle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Partnerships between colleges and companies have been around for decades now, mostly because they make sense. Companies get access to cutting-edge academic research. Colleges get a chance to offer real-life professional experiences for students and alumni. That is the way it worked back in the days of plentiful government funding for research and state college budgets before they shrank, as they have since the Great Recession. Now, it's just like companies stepping in to fill that funding gap, as Gigi Duban reports from Birmingham, Alabama.
Back in 2010, there was this virus going around on Facebook. It was called the Kubeface virus.
And the Kubeface virus was the first virus that we knew about that could actually infect your friends through your social network.
Gary Warner heads up computer forensics at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. The Kubeface virus would log into users' accounts with stolen info
and send messages to all of your friends on Facebook that said something like, "I can't believe this video caught you naked," and has a picture of a shower curtain.
Users would click on it, and boom, all their friends would get infected. Warner put a graduate student on the case full time.
And we actually wrote a program that was able to enumerate every Facebook account that had been stolen by the criminal.
They shared info about the hacked accounts with Facebook, and the company was grateful, to say the least. So grateful, Facebook built a $250,000 wing in the university's computer forensics department.
So what we're about to walk into now is the Facebook suite, which is about 4,400 square feet of space that was bare concrete until Facebook approached us with a suggestion about what we could do.
The Facebook suite feels very Silicon Valley. It has sleek chairs and trendy lighting, but the relationship goes way beyond a shiny new space. Facebook and UAB consult with each other on what to research and even what to teach. And this is typical nowadays when corporations team up with colleges. Relationships are cozier and more targeted. Jennifer Henley is director of security operations at Facebook. She says there's a reason Facebook is partnering with the University of Alabama at Birmingham. It builds a pool of candidates with the right job skills.
The reason why is they are giving hands-on, real-world experience to students about the type of issues we face on a day-to-day in the security space.
Facebook offers scholarships and flies top students to conferences. Henley says the company needs to fill a pipeline gap.
By the year 2020, they predict that we're going to have over two-thirds of security jobs unfilled.
So getting graduates into jobs is good for colleges. Letting companies have too much control? Not good. In fact, Donald Heller, dean of the education school at Michigan State, says universities are careful to avoid this.
But on the other hand, the universities want to enjoy the resources that the corporations can provide. So there's a very fine dance that goes on between the two parties to make sure that both are getting what they want out of the relationship.
Heller says companies are looking for an immediate return on that investment. It could be research that makes the foods we eat safer or a medical breakthrough that helps prevent heart attacks.
So certainly research is an important outcome of these relationships, but also, eventually hiring the graduates of universities and they're checking out the corporation and the corporation is checking them out as a potential future employee. So that's an important outcome of the process as well.
And the more colleges give their students a golden ticket to the real world, the better they look. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up, Hollywood loves politics, and politicians do love them some Hollywood.
People do make money out of this connection.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, not exactly a manic Monday, you guys. Dow Industrials dip less than a 10%, 9 points closed at 16,937. The NASDAQ pretty much flat, 4,368. The S&P 500 also flat, ended pretty much where it started, 19 and 62. Financials moved higher. J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup each picked up more than 1%. Morgan Stanley added 0.7%. Goldman Sachs tacked on 0.2% today. Housing stocks made some additions after strong new data on existing home sales. Pulte Group stepped up 1.2% today. KB Home climbed 1.25%. Toll Brothers pretty much flat, the theme of the day. Oracle's buying binge continues to pay off. Stock in the tech company rose 2/3 of 1% today on news it would acquire Micros Systems, which added 3.33%. The celebration at American Apparel seems to have come to an end after a big jump Friday on news the company had canned its CEO, Dove Charney. The stock was off more than 2% today. Charney, by the way, said he is going to fight back. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.62%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department lets us know how many new homes were sold in May. On Capitol Hill, Congress's Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing on the economic impact of increased natural gas production. And in London, the tennis tournament Wimbledon enters its second day and continues through July 6th. Strawberries and cream all around. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Business and economics being what it is, that is bewildering sometimes. We have got just the thing, a series in which you, the listeners, send in your sticky economic questions. We and our reporters find the answer.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman with I've Always Wondered, the Dudes Edition.
Listener Brock Groth lives in San Francisco. He works in the medical industry. He called in this query about marketing.
Well, I've always wondered why marketers care so much about the male 21 to 35 demographic.
Now that he's in his mid-40s, he says he's got way more money. So why are guys half his age so much more attractive to advertisers? Well, short answer is, it's actually the opposite sex they spend the most on. Women are the big deciders on most consumer purchases. But Groth is also right. Just check the Hollywood Trades or Ad Age. Plenty of money and star power is being thrown at the young dude market. Like those super expensive testosterone-pumped Super Bowl ads. In this one for Reebok, an NFL linebacker provides workplace motivation to office dweebs in the form of body blows.
Hey, buddy.
Break was over 15 minutes ago, Mitch!
And since ads aimed at young guys peddle sex, of course. And then there's the all-important ratings battle on late-night TV. It's like frat boy Comedy Central.
Wait, I'm barfing.
Okay, what have we learned so far about young men as a target market? They're macho wannabes, slaves to sex, and totally immature. So why waste all those marketing dollars on them? Surely they're going to grow out of this eventually. Retail analyst Patty Edwards at U.S. Bank says it's all about the money they'll spend before they grow up. Hook them now to keep them when they're older and have even more to spend.
That 18 to 34-year-old male demographic are either newly married or not yet married. In a lot of cases, they're living at home or they're living with friends. They have a lot of disposable income.
Doesn't matter if he's a high-paid Wall Street trader or your average air conditioner repairman, says Edwards. That paycheck's burning a hole in his pocket and he's a pushover to part with it.
They may or may not have a lot of money to spend, but a bottle of aftershave, if it gets you the girl, it's worth every penny.
Government consumer spending data show young men spend more than young women overall and in key categories for marketers: new cars and trucks, alcohol, entertainment. For booze and eating out, they even spend more than older, richer men.
Guys don't just go to McDonald's once a week. Guys go out for fast food 5, 6, 7 times a week, sometimes more than
that.
Which is sad. It's pathetic. And yet that's what makes them so attractive, is they seem to be more likely to spend that which they have.
I headed out one night recently to find some guys to test our marketing theories. As it happens, I got lucky.
So it's beer week in Portland, Oregon. The brew pubs are full of the 18 to 34-year-old male. So let's see what we find out.
At this crowded pub, you order a craft beer, and how perfect is this, guys? You get a free slice of bacon. I met Connor Wing drinking with a friend. He's 26, works in TV. I asked how often he goes out.
2 to 3 times a week. Depends on how frisky we are, you know, or what the week's feeling like. Beer's good.
And how much do you drop?
When I was single, I'd pick up the tab. You know, I just like people to have a good time. So, you know, now that I have a house payment and stuff like that, it's dropped down a bit.
And then, kind of embarrassing, I knock over a beer with my microphone.
Excuse me.
And the interview is over. Anyway, Patty Edwards says this is typical. Women enter the picture and young men buy less stuff. Women tend to figure out what they can afford and know how to wait.
It's actually women that control the majority of spending, even over this demographic. And it's because no guy does much of anything without permission from his wife or girlfriend.
So why then is the 18 to 34-year-old male still such a key demographic for marketers? Because his wallet's full. He spends what he wants without thinking too much about what he needs. So if you're Bud or Jeep or Nike, you want to get him hooked on your brand before someone with more grown-up spending habits, likely a woman, starts putting him right. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There are two ways you could go when talking about Hollywood and American politics. The first, you might call the Reagan approach. Genial and charismatic actor becomes the leader of the free world, establishes enduring mythology. The second, you might call the follow the money approach. Rich industry types shower campaign cash on supplicant candidates, establish enduring methodology. Timothy Stanley combines the two in his new book. It's called Citizen Hollywood, How the Collaboration Between L.A. and D.C. Revolutionized American Politics. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
This is not a new thing, Hollywood and celebrities. I mean, I know it's been sort of all the rage the past couple of cycles, but, you know, you had FDR and Warner Brothers, too, for crying out loud.
You did, and that was very much a business decision. The Warner Brothers, like most of the big American moguls in the 1920s, were good Republicans. Mm. They did some polling in about 1932, realized he was going to win, and so they switched their vote. So that speaks to how Hollywood has always played a big role in politics, and it's always been driven by a mix of obsession and fascination with power, a desire to be seen with the celebrity that is politics, but also hard-headed business decisions. People do make money out of this connection.
In fact, you say, and we'll get to the actual business part of it later, you say that Hollywood has largely fed the addiction that we have to campaign money in this country. They're just the suppliers.
It has contributed enormously. Not for nothing is it known as Washington's ATM. For example, in the last cycle, in 1 month alone in October during 2012, Hollywood raised an astonishing $13 million. So certainly it's able to produce a large amount of money and has done that throughout its history.
There is a neat symmetry, it seems to me, between the packaging of Hollywood stars and the Hollywood product and the packaging of politicians and the presidential product.
Yeah, no, there absolutely is. And those two developed sort of together at the same time. So one big East Coast investor in Hollywood in the 1940s and 1950s is Joe Kennedy. Mm. And when he wants Jack to run for the presidency, where does he send him to go and learn charm and star power? He sends him to Hollywood. And Jack actually meets actors. And so the Kennedys discovered that what it required was being seen with beautiful people, was going to expensive events, and developing that Camelot glamour.
There is a business relationship aspect to the D.C.-Hollywood connection, right? I mean, these are big entertainment companies that want to merge. They have regulatory interests. They are not in front of politicians sheerly out of altruism and, gosh, I like you, I hope you get elected.
Absolutely not. And one of the irritating things about Hollywood is that it pretends that it is. It pretends it's all about idealism. It's always been understood that there is it's a relationship based upon reciprocity. People expect to get something out of it. Quite often, in business terms, Hollywood fails. That's the interesting thing, is that Hollywood, I think, has deluded itself over the last few decades that it gets something out of it. It tends not to. You know, Hollywood giving all this money to Jerry Brown, he won't even come out and support tax breaks to get production back to California for movies projects. So even though Hollywood does all of this and convinces itself as idealistic, but ultimately it's about business, Hollywood so often does not actually get what it wants.
There are other centers of power and influence in this country that try to have a relationship with Washington. Certainly Wall Street is one, Silicon Valley and the tech industry is another. This one, though, I wonder if it isn't a little bit more depressing than the other two.
I think it is depressing because it has had an effect on the way politics itself is actually done. the rise of the idea of the celebrity, the rise of the importance of having named friends who can get you somewhere. But most of all, Hollywood has encouraged through its image making this idea that Republicans have to all be cowboys like John Wayne, and that Democrats all have to be like the West Wing, and they have to act up to that too. So I really think that that's its most poisonous impact. It's not healthy for a constitutional republic to have that kind of glamorization of its political leaders.
The book is called Citizen Hollywood. It is by Timothy Stanley. Timothy, thanks very much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which I will, with great, great effort, nay, Herculean effort, not go into the way that most Americans pronounce the acronym GIF, because you guys know how I feel about that. But bloggers at eBay did a poll asking people how they pronounce some other tech-related words, and the results are, honestly, kind of interesting. 55% of people say data, 42% say data, 91% say Wi-Fi, 8% somehow say Wi-Fi, 65% of people call a remote control a remote, only 5% say clicker. I say, let's call the whole thing off, all right? All right, we're done. That is Marketplace on this Monday. Today, the markets were boring. They were just boring. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Tommy Andres, and Millie Jefferson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. It's GIF, also APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.